well, apparently there were some people that even we didn't like, and we were like, hey, get out of here. So I guess they started walking south. They probably stopped at the colonies, and people were like, oh my god, those people don't like you. So they kept going, and now we have Rhode Island. That is not an accurate history of the founding of Rhode Island, but it's broadly accurate.
Welcome to The Buck Starts Here, the podcast that digs deep under the surface, examining the policies, people, and wild events that shape the presidencies of the United States. Or welcome back, I should say. It'd be a little odd to pick part three of John Adams for your first episode, but, you know, I guess, you know, do you. I'm Kyle, guardrails to our opinionated chief economist, Eric Mason, and today we're exploring the key people and events that shaped our second president's term in office. Eric, you want to remind us what we discussed last time we recorded, which I think was, what, 3 weeks for us?
Yeah. Oh,
it's been a bit.
Good Thanksgiving break. And,
right.
You know, Kyle does have to, you know, he can't be exposed to me too long. The guardrails are for your protection, not mine.
Yes.
especially when it comes to John Adams.
Do you know how much time I've spent looking into Canada and their prisoner of war treatment?
Yeah, dude, Canada. I can't wait for Joel. And we'll be covering on the show the burning of D.C. by our dear Canadian friends. And we will make Joel feel awkward, and he will have to explain the actions of his country from 200 years ago.
All right. Now that we're going to have to cut all that out of here, you wanna go ahead and fill us in on what we talked about last time.
Yeah, absolutely. So we covered most the major policies. We all know the Alien and Sedition Acts. Under John Adams, prior to that, we talked about his role in the Boston Massacre, his upbringing, you know, the founding of the U.S. Navy was a big one. You know, John Adams was, you know, a lot different than Washington. Washington was the unanimous consensus. He was the man for the moment, undisputed in his role. Where Adams is different. Adams is cantankerous. He's the reason the vice president to this day is not allowed to talk in the Senate. He is the original Bostonian. He's the original masshole.
You know, does he have the accent too?
I hope. So fun fact, Kyle, that you brought it up, is the way I'm talking is the way the colonists talked. Yeah, so the Brits changed their accent after the Revolutionary War because they want to sound like the colonists. So as I tell my wife, who's from the South, I'm speaking original English, all right? So this, like, towny accent, this is what they all sound like. So George Washington sounded like he was from Boston or New York or Philly, all right? So take that. We're the originalists. Non-arrhythmic R is sometimes what it's called. And, like, the New York accent, the Philly accent, Boston, Australian accents, all kind of in that family. Very different accents, but are they different accents? I feel like I sound different than somebody from New York.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, coffee. That makes me feel better about myself.
Say coffee.
Coffee.
Yeah, in New York, it's coffee.
Oh, that takes too long to say.
Right?
Rhode Island, low-key, very distinct accent. I feel the rest of the country doesn't realize that Rhode Island sounds, like, so different.
I think they're catching on now that Family Guy got big, but yeah.
Yeah, that is true. Rhode Island's the weirdest state in America, by the way, and that could always be for a future discussion, but so if you're in Quincy, I guess this links back to John Adams. If you ever decide to visit John Adams or Abigail Adams' burial place.
Which is where I'm at right now.
Yes, actually, literally, you're in the burial. Right. I destroyed my head walking into those crypts.
Oh, yeah, that thing is very, very short.
Very short. But here's the bad part. It's so short, like, I should have ducked underneath it. I couldn't duck low enough before I hit my head. So it was horrible.
It's one of those ones where you duck into it.
Sometimes when I get on, like, regional jets, that happens.
Yeah.
I go to duck in, and I end up clipping the top of my head because...
Yeah, start wearing a hat, man. That bill protects
you. Dude,
that's
a good idea.
Yeah.
So if you go to... If you're ever visiting the Adams Estates, and you go right down the road, it's literally the same road they're on. You just stay on that road. You'll see the Wollaston Firehouse, and there's a sign outside of it, and that's actually covers the founding of Rhode Island. So... Like, the Puritans down in Plymouth, the Pilgrims, they didn't like us, all right? They didn't like the guys who founded Quincy, because, like, we were traitors. We wanted to, you know, party. I mean, the Maypole was just basically a place to hang out. That was in Marymount. John Morton and his merry men. And so we'd go drop off stuff to the Pilgrims, be like, yo, let's go party. They're like, get away from us. So they went up here, and Quincy Harbor is the largest harbor in the Boston Harbor system. Quincy Bay, I should say, is the largest bay in the harbor system. So they came and chilled with us. The Hemrock, which was the seat of government for the local indigenous tribes. So they did a ton of trading there. It was all fun and dandy. Well, apparently, there were some people leaving we didn't like, and we were like, hey, get out of here. So I guess they started walking south. They probably stopped at the colonies. And people were like, oh my god, those people don't like you. So they kept going, and now we have Rhode Island. That is not an accurate history of the founding of Rhode Island, but it's broadly accurate.
Actually, now that you mention inaccuracies, I do have some stuff from our editor from the previous episodes this. That we needed to clarify some things here.
Yes.
The medical term that we were looking for, we were talking about like the fluids and the bile, and we couldn't figure it out. It was the humors. Yeah. The four humors.
Oh,
yeah.
That's a good one.
Thank you, Laura, for that one. There is another one. Yeah. Desiree, from several of the people who have been proof listening to these episodes, have said that that county in Utah that we talked about in like the first couple episodes, that's pronounced Desiree, not Desire.
What did I say?
I think you called it Desire. Yeah.
I could see that.
Yeah.
I barely speak
English. I've had several people tell me, I should know that. You were raised Mormon. Yeah. You should know that. It's like, no. I wasn't old enough to care about the financial strength of the church. and then there's one other question on here was the clarifying the statement about the Adams estate being the only estate surviving in its original condition.
Yeah, so this is a controversial, not controversial. It depends on what you mean by surviving its original condition.
Yes, okay. Because so it seems you can see Mount Vernon still exists, Thomas Jefferson's Monticello still exists. There's quite a few.
I believe those are largely rebuilt. I want to double check this one.
That was the question that we had, but we weren't really quite sure.
Yeah, it looks like it was. Yeah, so the rebuilt began in the 1800s for Mount Vernon.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually been I'm getting this right for Mount Vernon's official site. Yeah, so 12 of the original buildings fell into disrepair, and they had to rebuild them. So there was never a rebuild of the Adams Estates.
Right.
You could walk around and see like
it's all the original wood that was put in. Yeah.
And I believe Monticello got like destroyed at one point. Like really. Yeah, it got knocked down. His home got knocked down. Yeah, in 1796, the walls of the original home were knocked down.
See, that's
and expanded. They knocked down his original home.
It's like when you go to like see the Great Wall of China, and then you're walking around, and you're looking, and you see the little plaque that says this picture was rebuilt in 1980. Like, oh, great, thank you. Yeah. So the M5 in Europe is older than that.
Yeah. Oh, no, right. Monticello was. I knew Monticello was because that's like probably the most tightly connected president to Adams and Jefferson. I knew it was bad. I just looked it up. I didn't realize they have an entire page just devoted to the how they had to fix the house.
Jesus.
On their official website. Yeah. So that's the weird thing about the Adams Estates. You can go see it. And Kyle, I think you saw it there. You can see where John Adams left his walking cane the day he died.
Right, right.
It's just sitting there.
Yeah.
You can see.
Like, not anymore. Huh? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. It's like picking up. You can see like when John Quincy Adams died. You can see like stuff that was sent to Louisa Catherine and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's just sitting there. I mean, they have, I think it's like it was from the 1840s, like this tapestry that was put together by the daughters of the revolution. That's just like hanging over an old secretary desk. Like you don't have that with the other originally founded fathers. Right. They either died poor or their estates got like completely destroyed.
It's like going to see the Paul Revere house. It's like, this is what we think it might have looked like, and items that we think might have been in there, but we don't know.
As opposed to the Adams Estates. You can see the room that, like, John Adams ate in.
Yeah.
You can see his office is still there, so it is quite interesting. I find it. I'm willing to defend that, despite I also understand the controversy around it.
Well, when we talk about estate, too, like, I thought the point was that he was the only one who didn't die penniless, and then I think we have Abigail Adams to thank for that, as you kind of alluded to in the previous episodes and her purchasing of municipal bonds. Yeah. So how did she save the estate then?
Yeah, I mean, the interesting part, and this is really cool that makes America really, really fascinating, is the Adams, the Adams family, despite being those are one of my favorite shows growing up, too. Yeah. Also, I get called Lurch a lot. And imagine being called Lurch and sharing the building that John Quincy Adams used while he was in Congress. Like, it's too perfect. It's going to be a Cousin It joke. Cousin It was my favorite character. Nothing to do with this show, but I'm just going to throw that out there. Yeah, so Abigail Adams is probably the first diversified investor that we really have evidence, like really tight evidence of what she was investing. It was like land, real estate, all that stuff. Hmm. But in terms of how she saved the estate, it wasn't just like her individual actions. If you look at the history of people who came after Adams, I mean, and I mean like his, like the family line, mm-hmm. you know, Charles Francis, you had all these other famous Adams. Some became the Secretary of the Navy. Others became very prominent. You know, they were good, successful, well-educated people afterwards that carried on the name. You don't have that with Washington. Yeah. You don't have that with Jefferson. You don't have that with Madison or Monroe. I mean, Abraham Lincoln's bloodline's dead. It died out in the 80s. Like, it's very rare. I mean, you do have the examples of, like, Adams and Adams for father-son, Harrison and Harrison, grandfather, grandson, and then, obviously, the Bushes. But generally speaking, that's rare. It is wild to think all the father-son duos were tied to Massachusetts. That is right? Kind of funny. Funny. So that, like, basis of education, that good investment. I mean, even to this day, there's still the Adams Academy. Like, the Adamses left money that still exists to this day to take care, to support, you know, stuff like public education and mm-hmm. Historic preservation. They were a savvy group of people, very moral, very savvy investing family. It's also important to remember that if we look at the first six presidents, right, four from Virginia, the other two were named John Adams. Like, they were.
It's very such weird. A funny statement.
All right. They were agrarian based cultures. A lot of it was land usage. Mm-hmm. And the idea of owning land at that time period, we talked a little bit about this during the Washington episode, was that it was a status symbol, right? Like, you own land for a status symbol. Throughout your life, you would buy goods. And then when you retire, you would sell those trinkets and goods you collect from around the world as part of your retirement. Abigail Adams was different. She invested in land, mm-hmm. not land as in like, I'm going to, you know, harvest the, or unfortunately, I'm going to enslave people to harvest the fruits of this land. I'm going to use land speculatively mm-hmm. for business practices. I'm going to buy bonds. I'm going to invest in other people's businesses. I'm going to provide low interest loans.
Our first bank.
Kind of like she is. Yeah. And I know we're going to do a whole episode on Abigail, and we should do several episodes on just how amazing she was. But I won't torture Kyle with me explaining how every move she did was should be documented. But that's what carried the wealth. It was that wealth. It was prudent investment mixed with good education. It's kind of this weird recipe. Who would have guessed that if you're prudent with your finances and get, you know, a good education and a profitable enterprise that you could sustain wealth? But I'm just throwing out, it is bizarre that the only founding father who didn't exploit human beings is the only one whose lineage carried on and didn't die poor.
Actually had something left over.
And his children became incredible. His children and grandchildren, great-grandchildren became prominent. I mean, there were still Adamses living, you know, in Quincy and in that estate up into the 60s, 70s, and I think even into the early 80s. Mm-hmm.
How weird would that be? Like, yeah, we're going to go vacation in Quincy. We're going to stay at my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather's house. He built it when he was president. Right. Well, speaking of Abigail, one more thought with that is that we probably should try to put together her investment plan. Like, I'd love to see an analysis of that and then see if we can't, like, craft a modern day version of that. I think that'd be a lot of fun.
Oh my God. We should get like banks or somebody.
Right. Yeah.
That'd be a blast. That'd be a really good episode to do. Yeah. Yeah. But she was like diversified. She's also the reason that like inoculation and the precursor for vaccination came to the U.S.
That's right. She was she put her kids up for it. Right. Like one of the first, and they just approved everybody else that was safe. I think she took it or had her kids take it. Right.
Yeah. So they used, back in the day for smallpox vaccination, somebody realized that, wow, it's weird. Milkmaids don't get smallpox. Hmm. That's because they get exposed to cowpox. So, like, Catherine the Great was the first to be like, oh, let's... You know, well, obviously, Catherine the Great wasn't the one, like, mixing up the inoculation, right. But she was the first one to make it prominent. And Abigail, being a very worldly woman like she was like, I'm going to do this. And she gave it to all her kids, and they never... I don't know if they ever got smallpox, because that's how... We all know how vaccines work, right? Like, you can still get the thing. It just doesn't kill you. It's like
it's a weaker version of it.
Yeah. The flu shot is not made... It isn't designed to make you not get the flu. It's designed so the flu doesn't kill you if you get the flu. But And yeah, the more you dive into Abigail Adams, the more you're like, oh my word, this woman was so far ahead of her time. She had a, I think I mentioned last episode that she had a African-American worker at her house, and he wanted to get educated, so she put him through school. And she would intentionally, like, get in arguments with other prominent people around, not just the Boston area, but around the country, just so she could argue in favor of educating all people. I'm just like, I love this lady.
Wow. Yeah, we're going to dedicate a new church to her. All right, before we spend the whole episode talking about her, yeah. Since we're planning on doing that for part four, we should probably talk about some of the other characters in the time period.
Yeah, so I think one of the... All right, so we all know the story between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. And man, it was the election of 1800, and we covered it a little bit previously. It was just a gross election.
You kind of told me a couple snippets of that, but all I really got out of it was that Jefferson called Adams a hermaphrodite through multiple publications.
Yeah, I believe that's the exact word he used. I'm gonna verify.
It's good to know that politics hasn't changed either.
Yeah, because here's the thing, like Jefferson had this like weird. I know we're gonna cover him. All right, so I don't want to get too off track, but I find Jefferson to be one of the most interesting minds to ever be president, mm-hmm. because he's really just a bizarre dude. He really, like, why is he, like, I don't know why he's on Mount Washington. I feel like that was
Mount what?
I think it was a whiff. Sorry, Mount Rushmore. Mount Washington. I'm too much of a New Englander. I'm like, yeah, old man in the mountain. Which I don't even. Yeah, so he. So the exact quote. This is. I want to read this. So this is from Thomas Jefferson, right? So just to explain the election of 1800. Sorry, anybody listening to this, you have not lived in the most contentious time in U.S. history for elections. You haven't. That was the election. The worst election of all time was the election of 1860. And if you don't disagree with me on it, my evidence is a civil war started because of it.
Like, right. Right.
Yeah. So whenever people are like, we're living in the most divisive times in the United States, I'm like, we burnt down a major city in the U.S. during a time. I don't agree with that. Number two is the election of 1800, Adams and Jefferson. I'd say number three was the election between Hayes and Tilden, because that ended pretty much into Reconstruction. And then my last one on that list would be the election of 1828, Adams and Jackson.
Are you not including anything recent history, or you just you don't think that they measure up to any of those?
A little bit of A, a little bit of B. I think it's like you have to be far enough away. Like I think when you had the bargain between Tilden and Hayes. And Hayes took office, and we pulled troops out of the South. I don't think like they saw Jim Crow laws coming because of then. Mm-hmm. Maybe they did, but like I don't think they realized that this would just like set back human evolution by like 50 years, 100 right. years. So yeah, maybe. I mean, I don't know. I feel like the 2020 election would probably be up there too.
But need more time to really be able to analyze it. Yeah.
I mean, every election seems contentious, right?
As it's going on.
All right. So, what Jefferson did, and I guarantee, because there's a bunch of people who love Jefferson, but so I'm sure if you know, I might take a lot of flack for this. But Jefferson leveraged a lot of these newspaper editors to write what he wanted. Mm-hmm. And so, there was this famous news author who ran a very, very partisan newspaper. Fox News and CNN would look like the Wall Street Journal and The Hill. All right, compared to... See, I picked somebody on both sides, so now you guys can't yell at me. Yeah. And if you're yelling at me about that, that's your fault, not mine. So there's this guy, James Callender, and he had a publication called The Prospect Before Us. It was published around this election. And so Jefferson, this isn't like emphatic evidence, right? This is some stuff that's been speculated in different articles and stuff. Remember, this isn't like people don't document this stuff as it goes along. But James Callender and Thomas Jefferson, I believe Callender was actually somebody who was subjected under the Alien Sedition Act under Adams. So yeah, he already hated Adams. So maybe he said this himself. But it's why, you know, there's a good idea that Jefferson... very much heavily influenced, which is he described John Adams's character as hideous, hermaphroditical character, which has neither the force or firmness of a man, nor the gentleness and sensibility of a woman. That's a quote. I mean, like, I'm like, I can send the link. It's actually on the Monticello site. Like, yeah, I'm serious.
Yeah, give me that quote. I'll make sure it gets in there. Yeah, well,
hold on. This is going in there. The same site that tells you about the houses having rebuilt. By the way, I don't know why, but if anybody ever goes on the Monticello website, it's a very zoomed in picture of Jefferson as the little icon, little thumbnail screen.
Because if you zoomed out, you'd see a lot of things that you didn't want to.
Yeah, so check this out. Exactly. Yeah, no, so like, just so everybody knows, that's like, Kyle's 100% right. This is... Where is it? Yeah. That's a... Imagine how many points that would be if you pulled that word out in Scrabble.
Right.
Yeah, there's a president calling another president that.
Wow.
Kind of wild.
I think it's hilarious they put it on their website.
Yeah,
proud of it.
Yeah, to give a lot of these places, like especially Monticello, like a lot of credit, is that they get the complexity of Jefferson. Like, mm-hmm. we'll cover more into him, but he's a weird character in history.
Yeah.
So yeah, contentious to say the least. But they have such a weird history. So they do like each other, and they spent the last 20 years of their life reconnecting. 20-ish years, the last 15 years of life reconnecting.
Reconnecting or competing to see who can live longer?
Are those the same things? No, they both died, as we talked before. They both died on the same day. I mean, yeah. Adam's famous last words were Jefferson lives, even though Jefferson had already exited before. I guess it was one more jab by Jefferson to make sure Adams was wrong at his last breath. But it's funny. So these are real people. That's the thing. Yeah, these are real people. And we forget that sometimes because these people are titans. Like, they're just titans. It was so long ago relative to us. It was in such a time of murkiness. I mean, I was very shocked to find out a lot of people didn't know that Washington had a brother. Right. And the amount of people I've told to after our first episode, who I talked to like at work and my group of friends are like, Washington didn't have a brother. Like, right? No, he's the reason he wanted to become a general. Like, right? His brother was hugely impactful in his life. But these are real people. And I think, you know, you have the person, right? So if we can remove all the grandiose of being, you know, a Hegelian Superman and being that person at some time, what's important to remember is both John Adams and Thomas Jefferson were parents.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thomas Jefferson's wife died very young. And Thomas Jefferson, well, we'll talk about a little bit more of his kids with an S.
Yeah.
He had a daughter, Mary Jefferson. Polly was what she went by.
Okay.
And when Jefferson was over in France, he was sent for Polly. And at the time, the Adamses were in England, basically acting as a consulate there. It is very funny. Adams, when he was in England, he was the greatest American. He was, because he refused to curtail, follow court, court of the king procedures.
You're right.
And stuff
I'm not bowing to you. You're not my king.
Oh, no, because you beat him.
Yeah.
You beat him.
You kissed my ring.
You won. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So he was seen as like uncivilized and seen as like kind of swinish with some of the terms that were used.
I always wonder about that. Would you bow to the king if you ever got to meet? Yeah, I wouldn't either.
No, I'd kiss the Pope's ring, but I feel like it's pretty open that I'm very a practicing Catholic, so I'd feel weird on that one. But no, what? That's weird. Why would I do that? America, we don't even tip the flag in it, like during like parades and stuff, because we won.
Yes, like, yes,
we won. That's why I like Morocco. Morocco is just like, you guys won. You beat the number one guy. You're not ranked number one. It's like college football, Paul. Peace deal.
I remember them saying, so I don't know if this is right or not, but I remember something about our salute being down was something to do with the fact that we never lost a war officially.
Yeah, I mean, we've only fought five wars, and we very handedly won all five times we declared war. Like, there was not a gray area, whether or not, like, we owned the Philippines for, like, 50 years afterwards. That was, fun fact about the Philippines, they celebrate July 4th, because we... Mm-hmm. After World War II, we released the Philippines, gave them independency on July 4th. So I kind of think that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
So Jefferson sends her Polly, and you know this is late 1700s, right? Like this isn't normal travel. So she's escorted across the Atlantic by a colonel. I believe it was a colonel. Might have even been might have been slightly higher. Actually, Kyle, I'll defer to you. I don't know. Because after Colonel becomes General, but I know he wasn't a General. I distinctly remember him never being referenced as a General.
Yeah. Yeah.
She gets brought over. And so this is 1787-ish.
So that's real early.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So Articles of Confederation prior to the U.S. Constitution being adopted. So it's kind of, this is, I just love this. So Abigail Adams and Jefferson always maintained contact. They may have had a few years off and on, but she was the one who restarted it.
Mm-hmm.
So Jefferson was, didn't know what to do. So he emails, geez, he writes a letter. please keep that in. I like that.
I know, right? Yeah.
He writes a letter to, but that's how human they are. This is something you could see happening today.
Yeah.
So he writes a letter to Abigail, and he's describes Polly. Now you got to understand, Polly lost her mom. Mm-hmm. Like, she didn't have that, and you're living in a huge estate in the countryside. Like, it's not like you're going to cotillions and stuff like that. And Polly, as Jefferson basically described her, as painfully shy. She was uneasy, but she was brilliant, crazy brilliant. Well, let me tell you about another brilliant woman that Thomas Jefferson knew, Abigail Adams. So he writes a letter to Abigail, and he's like, hey, Abby, I'm going to send my daughter. She's going to come over. She's going to be escorted over here. Can you, keep an eye on her. Bring her into the family. And it's funny because she ends up staying in London for, I think, a couple weeks. And she completely comes out of her shell and really develops this almost like maternal feeling. Like, and again, as Polly grew older, we don't have evidence that her and Abigail stayed in like super routine touch. We don't. We don't evidence they didn't either.
Right.
But you had this young woman who lost her mom, whose dad's on another continent, right? That's not easy to get to. And who does Jefferson turn to? He turns to the Adams.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so as much as they didn't like each other in politics,
had to at least respect each other.
Yeah, I think they loved each other. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of like sibling rivalry. Like, the person you love the most is sometimes the person you hate the most.
You could see them sitting in the study having a cocktail together, laughing about the publications that Thomas Jefferson got. I was like, why'd you call me this?
I'm a big believer in that, because if you read their private letters, they're funny. They're funny to each other. There's jokes going on. And they're actually kind of crap on you. It's kind of like a friend's group chat. Except, like, that got published, and he's like, oh, shit.
right.
I didn't know that was getting out. But it was funny, because Polly, being this, like, really reserved girl, and suddenly being in England, was, like, overstimulated and didn't know what was going on. So instead of Abigail was, like, reassuring her, but, like, taking her around everything, she's like, no, you're going to break out of your shell by breaking out of your shell. And eventually Colonel Short, that was the guy who escorted Polly over the Atlantic, it was weird. That was his title was secretary.
Mm-hmm.
They gave him a secretary who was a colonel, which just feels way overqualified.
Yeah, they do that a lot. Like, when you get the generals, attaches are usually like really high ranking colonels like that, I think.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. I don't think that's unnormal. It probably has to be, because you have to have some sort of authority to be able to tell other people to do things for him, and you don't really want like an E2 going around giving orders to other colonels.
All right, first off, that is awesome, Kyle. Love that insight on there. But yeah, so they had a really interesting relationship. So Abigail, you know, took Polly underneath her wings. Got, and even Jefferson remarks later on about how like she felt she was more out of her shell. And at the end of the day, I mean, they're people, right? Like,
yeah.
Your daughter lost her mom and is now traveling across the Atlantic, and you trust her to this guy you went through kind of hell with, right? Like, you found a new country with, and you're like, this is the man that I'm going to trust my daughter to help her.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care what happens 13 years later. That comment that we read earlier was only 13 years later.
Right.
You don't change that much in 13 years, right? Like, you don't. Like, you can have political disagreements, but this is beyond, family's beyond politics when it comes here. So it was, that election was super, super contentious. And Jefferson wins. It was really the first. It was the last election that you didn't run as top, like, you know, the ticket didn't run together. Jefferson. It was a close.
But
that's
still kind of a weird setup too, though, wasn't it? Where whoever got the most votes was still president, and like the ticket you ran on, you weren't necessarily running for president and vice president. You're just running as a ticket, and then the order of the votes determined what the position was. Is that right?
Yep. So you had to coordinate your votes. Yeah. So you could have ended up with Jefferson and Adams in theory, but by this time political parties had formed. So you had Jefferson running as a Democratic Republican, Adams as a Federalist. We've talked about this before, but Washington finished his presidency as a Federalist. He joined the party a second term. It was a win. People act like the Jefferson Adams win was like a beatdown by Jefferson. Mm-hmm. He won 73-65.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, like, he won by, I mean, if things don't change, he won by Pennsylvania.
Right.
Pennsylvania, nonstop, like a 250-year history of deciding presidents.
Well, I mean, can you pick a state and just give them that title? Is that just the way the math kind of works out?
Ooh, no, this is a good question. No, you're probably right about this, Kyle, because Florida was a swing state for almost 40 years. Kind of swing state, I should say. Yeah, I feel like it's, well, Ohio used to be too, as we know, but I don't know, man, maybe. I wonder what state has decided the most presidencies. I know Ohio is usually one of the best indicators of how an election's going to go if you look at the polling within the state, because of how it has a manufacturing, agrarian, professional services kind of all spread out. It tends to be a pretty good litmus test for the United States.
But that makes a lot of sense.
Really, that's really subjective. But
I'd imagine they have to be a state that's not voting the same way every year in order to be considered like that too, right?
Yeah, like not Massachusetts.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, election night in Massachusetts, it's funny, it's 8:01, and they call the state. Like, guys, we're going to have done this before.
Right.
So it ends up being... it's a little bit of a slacking on the popular vote. So he wins. Jefferson gets like well over 60% of the popular vote. But again, one of my favorite things to always do this is that was only 45,000 people.
I was going to say, what was the turnout back then?
Yeah, so between Jefferson and Adams, which was the vast majority of the electoral base, it was only about 94,000. Only about 74,000 votes.
Total votes cast? Total out of how many people?
I believe the population of the United States was a little north of 14 million at that time.
So not great turnout.
Yeah, well, I wonder how big the electorate was.
Yeah. Could everybody vote back then, or was that landowners only?
Land-owning white men.
Okay. So of that population, what was... You'd think the turnout of that population would be a lot higher, though, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I wonder if they...
You just fought a war to have the right to pick your own representation. You're not going to go exercise it?
No, but like, honestly, trying to see if they, so you can pull like polling data from here, but mm-hmm. the way back in the old days, they didn't really care about reporting like percentage of turnout. They only cared about reporting electoral victories. The data, we start really getting better data around like right around the end of the Civil War. You start getting like amazing, almost county specific data. I mean, we still have county specific data from back then, but yeah, I mean, it was if you look at electorals, it was a 53-47.
Yeah.
One of my favorite things, and you know I'm very biased towards, we talk to people I'm biased for, is John Jay. Mm-hmm. John Jay received, you probably, when you're doing the math, you probably realize there's one extra vote sitting out there. John Jay got a vote.
Oh, okay. Is that just because he did so well at that treaty?
I don't know. I feel like it's the people like me who lived in that time period and probably like, do you know what? You did a good job. I don't like that you keep getting crapped on. Here's one electoral college vote.
Yeah.
Which is more electoral college votes than I'll ever get in my life. So, I mean, I can't even... Honestly, getting one electoral college vote sounds the exact perfect amount of electoral college votes to get.
Right.
You don't have to be president, but you can hold that over all your friends. So, this election was the first, really, in the modern world, modern times. Enlightenment period, that we see a peaceful transfer of power. This was the big test, right? This was the
especially after a contentious election cycle, too.
Yeah, after somebody was called like a Mathodite, like wild insult. So everything you hear modern politicians saying, just remember that that's exactly how the founding of the country was. Right. Don't let you think these guys were powder woods. These were a bunch of 30 and 40 year olds crapping on each other, trying to run their country they founded. Then Aaron Burr then shot the first, the first treasurer.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And after he did that, he then fled to the West and tried to start an East-West civil war, not a North-South.
Oh.
Aaron Burr, one of the biggest pieces of crap in U.S. history.
When do we get to talk about him?
Oh, we will talk about it during Jefferson. You had a guy who sold his children into slavery, and then another guy who shot Alexander Hamilton.
Oh, that's right.
And we
that's
put him right. on yeah, Mount yeah, Rushmore. Yeah. That was interesting. But don't worry, we bought Louisiana. Even though Jefferson didn't believe presidents should be able to buy land. He didn't say they could in the Constitution, but... I have a hard time talking about Jefferson.
I know. Jefferson aside, anything else about Adams that we got to cover here before?
Yes. Yeah, so just kind of ending out Adams' legacy. What John Adams did, if John Adams had won two terms and then stepped down, whatever, that's the Washington standard, wouldn't become a law for another 200 years. He had to do that, but whatever. That would have been 150 years or whatever it was.
Was the two-term thing just because that was what Washington did and nobody wanted to go past what the precedent was?
Yeah, but only only people named Roosevelt went over that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Roosevelt did 10 years and then FDR did, well, he would have done 16.
Tried, yeah.
Really, really, really tried. But, so, yes. Was this a great moment in American history? The peaceful transfer of power? Absolutely. But who transferred the power? That was Adams.
Mm-hmm.
Adams believed in the system. He believed in the Constitution that he so heavily influenced. The Constitution that's based on the Constitution he wrote. The probably obscene amount of money he sent in books to Madison as the Constitution was being drafted. He believed in the words of the Declaration of Independence. And so when it came time for him to accept his defeat, he did it graciously. This cantankerous man, who again was the reason vice presidents can't talk in the Senate, a man who openly insulted people when he thought they were wrong, but his morality is unchallenged. And you can, you know the morality of a president by what they did at the hard moments. He turned over the keys. He turned over the keys to a man who insulted him, who represented a party that wrote malicious things about him. But he did it because it didn't matter what he said. That's the thing about John Adams. He told people right to their face what he believed and how he felt about them. But he also accepted it coming back the other way. Mm-hmm. And what does he do? He turns over power and preserves the precedent of that.
Let me take a step back. Do we really need to congratulate somebody for doing what they should have done? Like, is that really that big a deal?
Well, prior to this point in history, nobody's ever done it. Maybe Cincinnatus, under the Romans, but every single time if you look at, just a number of kings who, were kings.
Right.
But no, right. Should you congratulate people on doing what they should do? No, you shouldn't. But in this case, he had the opportunity to do what every other leader, kind of in human history, had done. Even today, we were recording this, a week after Assad was ousted in Syria? It was 50 years ago.
Okay.
Did the right thing.
Point taken.
Yeah.
I forget that it was a trend-setting thing. We get so used to the peaceful transfer of power here 200 years later, that it just doesn't strike you with the same significance that maybe it should.
Yeah. And I honestly think the world is waiting on bated breath. I like to think the monarchs in Europe are like, oh, let's see what these pilgrims, if they really live up to this whole peaceful transition of power. And he did.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. And then you look at his legacy from an economic standpoint. He founded the U.S. Navy. That's it. You founded, the most powerful anything ever on the face of the earth. And probably the strongest, besides currency and markets, probably the biggest influence on the global economy.
There was one other thing that we kind of talked about. Well, we have just a couple more minutes here. I just wanted to ask the thing going on with France, Napoleon basically running rampant over, in Europe, and then his decision to not support France during their revolution. Is there any fallout or any other things that kind of came out because of that decision?
So a little bit of a weirdness in the back on this, and Kyle, that's an absolutely excellent point. So France was in such a weird spot. Under Washington, it was a revolution, right?
Mm-hmm.
And who was Napoleon under Washington? He was a nobody. He wasn't even a member of the First Council of France at this point.
No, he's just some artilleryman in Corsica, right?
Bingo. He's just some artillery guy who seems to really, jive with his troops. I always have to say this, it's obligatory. Napoleon was not short.
No, he's not. He was average height for the time.
Yes, he was not short at all. They used the French cubit, is 20 inches. The traditional cubit is 18. That is why he is a different height. All right? Oh. But he was a normal sized person. I don't know where that, that's
it's,
that wasn't
it's
that
a political
long ago.
Cartoon. It's from a political cartoon that England did to try to make him look small in stature. They were just, they like to depict him as a little man, and I think that's where most of it came from.
Yeah, which is funny because like we kind of did that to England. Yeah. Remember after the Washington one, right. Where it's just like, why is George Washington 85 inches taller? Cornwell,
exactly.
Cornwell was not a short man. He was probably near Washington's height, but they made him look like a wicked short dude for some reason. I'm like, all right, man. I mean, I wouldn't do that. I'm just saying it's kind of weird.
Hey, it's the winners. That's what you get for being the winner.
Yeah, right.
so if Napoleon won, he would think he's 6 foot tall.
Dunking.
Right.
this painting from 1814, Napoleon inventing basketball.
Right.
So Napoleon at the time, so Napoleon's rise came under Adams. So 1799 was when Napoleon rose to be in the first council of France. Like, yeah, he was like the, I don't know what they call it. He was so, essentially the emperor of France, the king of France. But
who was actually asking for help, though? Was it Napoleon's side or the people trying to fight Napoleon?
So during the Revolution, the French Revolution, when they were asking us for help, it was the Committee of, what is it called? National Committee on Safety? National Safety Committee? That was like, I'm not joking. It's a hilarious name for right. for a committee. That's why it's always the top of my mind. They asked Washington for help, and Washington declined.
Mm-hmm.
Now, then we fought the quasi-war with the French during this period that we talked a little bit about.
Yeah.
So the French weren't like wanting that much help from us. But your question's great, Kyle, right? Because who was the quasi-war fought against? What France was it? Was it the revolutionary France, or was it this like quasi, I didn't mean to use the word quasi there twice, but like was this like proto-Napoleonic government?
Right.
Well, you know, the Napoleonic Code really doesn't come into effect until about 1801. So it's a little bit after Adams leaves. Now, I will say during Jefferson, international politics during Jefferson is going to be fascinating because Jefferson, if I remember earlier in the story, I was saying Jefferson was in France when he when he called Polly over. Jefferson loves France. That man is a loved France. That's why it's very weird because sometimes Adams gets crapped on because of the founding of the Navy. He didn't go mess with the Barbary States.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, oh, we founded this Navy. Why didn't you do anything with the Barbary States? Because they were asking tribute for us and Adams didn't send them over. Well, it's because Adams sent like massive ships down to just absolutely tool on the French in the Caribbean. Like, I like how the U.S. forms a Navy and the first thing they want to do is fight a two-front war. Like,
yeah.
The U.S. Navy has had the same battle doctrine for 220 years.
Bring them all. One or we'll take them all one at a time. We'll take them both at the other.
We will fight all the aircraft carriers at the same time.
Right.
I just hope the Navy rolls around with its own Air Force.
Yeah.
No, so the biggest legacy of John Adams, peaceful transition to power, but which is an economic huge thing. The reason the U.S. is so great to invest in is because, I mean, we're stable. Like, it's funny. I did do an economic presentation about a week ago for this year in seminar. And I had a draft. They brought me on to do it long before the 2024 elections. It was, I have a long section on tax policies. And I wrote that section out. And what I realized is that they weren't very different. That between the two candidates, the end of the road impact to corporate taxation really was the same. And that speaks to that long-term stability that is represented in John Adams' peaceful transfer of power. Peaceful transfer of power, then establishing the most powerful anything ever established in the U.S. Navy. And what does the U.S. Navy do? It provides free navigation of all the oceans at no cost to anybody besides the U.S. taxpayer. Like, by the way, the rest of the world, you're welcome. You're welcome that our tax dollars go to making things cheaper in your countries.
If you want to say thank you, you can email us at buckstarts,
US Navy.
buckstartsherepodcast.com or usnavy.gov, I think, works too.
Global force for good. We're not sponsored by the U.S. Navy.
Can we be? I don't know. Does the Navy get to sponsor stuff?
I just want to fly over.
Right? over this crypt.
Hey, when we committed, when the city did General's Bridge, we got a flyover.
Oh, that's right. Sick. Yeah.
Awesome. F-15s.
All right. Is that a good place to put a stamp on this one? Are we?
Yeah. Join us. Next episode, we'll go through Abigail Adams. And then,
Before we get any angry letters asking us why we didn't give her enough proper credit, which I feel like we kind of gave her a little more than we meant to. But listen to part four next week before you hit send on that email.
If you have the email, that's also true.
Do that too. If any corrections or criticisms, you can email those to buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com. I've been saying chinashopproductions@gmail.com, which works too, but Laura's been reminding me for the last 7 episodes to fix that in my script. So buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com is the official email. Remember to like, share, comment, all the things. You can visit the website at thebuckstartsherepodcast.com. We'll see you all next week.